This is Democracy,
a podcast that explores the interracial, intergenerational, and intersectional
unheard voices living in the world's
most influential democracy.
Welcome to our new episode of This is Democracy. Today we're going to talk about environmental policymaking in a democracy, a topic that is receiving a lot of attention now with the fires in California, a recent federal report on the dire concerns about our environment, and a new conference that's just opened in Poland with most of the major countries in the world, excluding the United States in some respects. We have with us, I think, probably one of the best people in the world to talk about this topic with, my colleague and friend Sheila Olmsted. Good morning, Sheila.
Good morning.
Sheila is a professor at the LBJ School. She's also served on the Council of Economic Advisors in the White House. She's taught at a number of universities and writes in particular about the intersection of economics and the environment, market conditions, and the ways in which markets work with and sometimes work against environmental policy with regard to water and various other resources. Before we turn to that discussion, though, we have another poem from Zachary. Zachary, what's the title of your poem this morning?
It's called So Fluorescently Away.
Okay, let's hear it.
I look out the window waking up at night, hold tight to my teddy bears, watch the white wind whistle against the electric poles, can see the green wilderness beyond along a sewage creek. I can feel the smell of the night creep in among the asphalt, can remember the cold water in the bathroom and my parched tongue. I can still hear the BBC echo through my ears, the wildfire sirens, earthquake images from decades ago flip like a slideshow through my mind. Sleeping and awake in the cold silence, warming under my blankets as the globe slips through the universe. And all oceans are all clear to me now. All the forested tundra frozen grassland land, it creeps, seeps like sleep into the clearing image of a globe. And I am awakened, it seems like only a few minutes later, by hard footsteps up the stairs, a jolt of the electric light. And I walk into the school under the fluorescence. And when I close my eyes, I can see the globe slipping so fluorescently away.
Well, that's a great image, Zachary. What is your message about the environment in your poem?
That we see it in our everyday lives, and we see the environment all around us, but we have trouble seeing the whole picture and seeing what's happening to our globe. And when we do see it, we just want to look away and not look at it.
Wow. Well, that's a perfect point to transition to Sheila here. Why do we have such trouble with environmental policy? Everyone seems to care about having clean air and having nice parks, but yet we seem stuck. Why is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I guess I would open by saying maybe to strike a little bit of a positive note and say that we've actually achieved just tremendous progress in the United States and even in countries like China, right, where, population has pushed really hard for better and more air quality regulation due to really significant pollution problems, especially in the cities. You know, if you think about where we were in the 1970s in the U.S., you know, air quality on the whole in U.S. cities was just so much worse than it is today. So we've made a huge amount of progress. But I think some of what Zachary's pointing to in his poem and some of what you're asking about has to do with climate change, which is the kind of mother of all environmental problems. You know, and one could take a pessimistic view and say, well, if we can't do something about that, then, you know, why talk about the progress we've made in other areas? And I would say, in a way, right, it's true to focus on that as something that's different and definitely harder than some of these other things that we've tackled. You know, the first president to ask for a report on climate change essentially was LBJ. We're talking 1965.
Right,
you know,
right.
He made a speech to Congress and he mentioned it. You know, we've known about it since the late 1800s. There were Swedish chemists, you know, that kind of worked out essentially the basic, you know, physics and atmospheric chemistry behind the problem. So it's true. We've known for a long time. It's a very hard problem to solve. And I would say largely that's because this is really a global problem. We could really do a lot to fix air quality in Los Angeles in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s by doing things internally, you know, within the United States and even just within the state of California to some extent. But this problem of climate change is something that essentially all countries have to kind of band together to do something about. And even though we've had this global process in place since 1992 with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which is the meeting that you were talking about today, it's one of many, many, you know, global meetings that have taken place. It's just a really thorny problem to solve when essentially everybody has to work together to do it.
Right. And just to get it out there, how do we know climate change is occurring?
Well, we know climate change is occurring for a lot of reasons. Even if you go back to the sort of basic predictions in the 1890s, right, by the original folks who thought about this in the physical sciences, a lot of what they've predicted has come to pass. Obviously, there's lots of uncertainty, but generally the idea, right, is that we are emitting lots of gases that have this kind of greenhouse effect, right, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. And when we increase the stock of those gases in the upper atmosphere of the Earth, when the sun's radiation comes in, less of it escapes, and so we have this general warming trend. And we know that that's happened because we've tracked for many decades now both the concentration of atmospheric carbon dioxide as well as global surface temperatures worldwide. And we can see this signal, you know, quite clearly of human-induced warming since the mid-1800s, since industrialization, in that data in lots and lots of places. The most famous, and so maybe the most well-known because it's been tracked the longest, is the Mauna Loa Observatory data, right, which has this sort of famous graph, right, showing this increase. And other things are consistent with that. We see increased acidification of oceans and freshwater resources. We see other things that are consistent with the story of that kind of human-induced warming, like more severe storms, more frequent downpours in some parts of the world, and so on, longer and more severe droughts, and so on. And as scientists get better and better at what's called attribution science, really taking these kind of individual events like the California drought or Hurricane Harvey or Superstorm Sandy, and kind of working out the probability that these events would have been that severe in the absence of human-induced warming, and finding that that probability is really, really small, we get better at saying what specifically, right, are the current results of that warming trend, and then also better at predicting, you know, what might happen in the future.
So if it is so obvious, and there are still some who deny, but if it's so obvious, why doesn't that mobilize global action? Why is it so hard?
Well, it's a great question. I think it almost, my answer has two parts. I mean, one is that we actually do see it mobilizing a lot of action. I think one reason it's hard is because one could argue that until fairly recently, lots of Americans, lots of, you know, kind of citizens in other parts of the world may not have felt the impacts of that warming directly, right, in their local communities, in their households, in their firms, right, if we're talking about people running businesses. But since about half of the warming that has occurred since the mid-1800s, late 1800s, has occurred since 1990, we've seen in recent decades this very rapid sort of series of changes where people are now, they find it perceptible, right, that the winters are, we're just not getting as much snow, or we're getting, you know, the winters are warmer, right, you know, we're seeing seasons change earlier.
Right, bigger hurricanes.
Bigger hurricanes, right. So when we see these kinds of effects, that's when we start to, right, that people start to feel those things, then it, you know, in some ways we see more action. And even though it's true that we've seen at the U.S. federal level, you know, perhaps less action than some people would have wanted since the political change in 2016 when President Obama left office and President Trump came into office, we certainly have seen a continuation at the local level, at the state level, right? There's sort of lots of you know, there's this "we're still in" movement, right? Even though the United States has announced its intention to withdraw from the Paris Accords in 2020, when it's possible for us to do that, still lots of folks that are taking action, even within the United States. I mean, the state of California is kind of your classic example,
right.
And you could say, "Oh, California, right? They're always kind of ahead of the curve on these environmental issues," and one might write that off. But I think it's very hard to write off, first of all, the scale of the attempts that California is making and the ambition of those attempts, and then also the fact that it's not just California.
Right.
Right. Lots of places, lots of cities around the U.S., exactly, that are taking significant measures, costly measures, right, to try to make a dent in this problem.
And how does it make a difference? Because oftentimes people will say to me, well, it's nice to do these small things, but if the world is, you know, warming
know,
up around us, what difference will it make?
Well, you know, it's funny because, again, as an economist, you know, maybe if you'd asked me 10 years ago, I would have given you exactly that answer. I would have said, it's a drop in the bucket.
Right.
You know, it's really hard to be positive, right, about those kinds of measures when I know the scale of the problem and that it really takes, right, if we don't tackle, you know, seriously emissions from countries like China and the United States, right, that going forward we're in real trouble. But then what you see is collectively, right, it's actually quite impressive. I mean, it's nothing an economist would have predicted, right? You know, we think about game theory and strategic interaction, and political scientists think about this too. And I think it's